Welcome to another That's a Dive, everyone. I'm Kyle Martino. What's up, Tad Potters? I'm doing better. If you listened to my last Tad Pod about U.S. soccer, I was struggling a bit. And I'm doing better because the Premier League's back. And if it didn't come back, I'd probably still be lying on the floor in my bedroom in the dark with the shades drawn, growing a beard and peeing in mason jars and just struggling. But I'm okay. I'm back. You know what else is back? Who else is back? Is producer Mike.
I'm back.
Back from your trip. The rolling hills of where were you? Tuscany?
I was in Tuscany. I endured that United States loss at 4 o'clock in the morning. Couldn't go back to sleep.
Okay, so I want you to tell the story of how you endured it. Because you went to bed thinking all was well and good.
I was way more worried for the Panama game.
Mm-hmm.
I set my alarm to wake up for that game.
Okay.
That was phenomenal news when I saw that. My son, who's going to be 2 in January, slept like a sack of logs, bricks? I don't know. He slept really well.
Good.
All vacation, which was awesome.
Yeah.
That night, he wakes me moaning and crying. I look at the clock. It's 4 o'clock in the morning, local time in Italy. I look at the score. I look at my phone. I have 37 text messages.
That's a bit above average.
That's more than I usually get in a month. And I was
knew something was up.
I knew something was up. I saw that they lost. I had to get my crying son. He had to hold me instead of me holding him.
Which is a challenge.
Which is weird because he's little. Because
he's 1 foot tall.
Yeah. God, that was terrible. I still have...
He knew.
I know.
Your son knew. Your son is like a U.S. soccer Nostradamus.
I guess.
He felt it in the air.
And you know what
And so wait, you, this is the middle of the night in Italy.
It's 4 a.m. That was like the 4 a.m. local time was the moment that the U.S., the final whistle was blown.
And your son had to put you back to bed.
He tried to. And then I woke up, like a couple hours,
And it was real.
And I was like, wait, what happened? Is that true? Did that really happen?
And
I didn't watch the highlights for weeks.
Yeah.
I just couldn't until I had
to. I don't blame you.
I'm doing the show review for the Premier League games this weekend.
Oh, we showed it.
Yeah.
Yeah, made me do it.
I know.
I said it on air. I couldn't believe they made me watch those again.
I felt the same way.
I was dying. I cried all over our shot sheets. So, of course, we're going to get a little bit into U.S. soccer and the topics today. In the last topic, because the dust has settled a little bit and we can maybe calmly talk about it again. But the Premier League's back. We have two Premier League topics. Before we get into those, I'm going to hit those reviews. You guys, Ty Potters, thanks so much for the reviews. Those who might be listening for the first time, we do reviews where you say what you think of the show, but then also tell me your great soccer moment, what hooked you, something that just made you fall in love with the game. And my favorite from this week, because it's a U.S. soccer memory, and we just need to start having good U.S. soccer memories again. The under-17s, by the way, are putting in some good U.S. soccer memories.
I know. I have a question
looking good.
For you about that later.
Okay. This is from Trippin' Billy 881. Obviously, 2010 U.S. Men's National Team World Cup was pure excitement. The Rob Green howler, Slovenia comeback, Landon's goal, followed by pure devastation at the hands of Ghana. Ghana. Keep doing it to us. That felt all too natural as a Mets, Jets, and Knicks fan. Oh, brutal. But that just started the engine, Trippin' Billy says. What kept me there was the FA Community Shield a few weeks later, Manchester United versus Chelsea, 41st minute. The ball Scholesy plays to Waza, who takes a look on the half volley, curls it, ground pass back to the spot where Tony V, I guess he means Antonio Valencia. I've never heard Tony V, but I love it.
Runs, I'm like, who are these
guys? Runs onto it and lifts it over the keeper. It was the moment I realized that what world class was, and what a game is supposed to look like in its finest. Probably played that back 20 times that day. Have been a diehard United fan ever since, which, given aforementioned rooting interest, might explain why they've been a bit crap the last few years. All the best, Kyle. Pod on. Thanks, Trippin' Billy. Thanks, everyone. Keep the reviews coming. Before we get into all the topics, the last one will be U.S. soccer, and then we have two Premier League topics, some Premier League breaking news. So check the phone before I came in here today. Now, we're taping this, so obviously there might be some updates later, but Craig Shakespeare. Craig Shakespeare is the second managerial casualty this year. The reports
reportedly
are, right now, from credible sources. I mean, everyone's going with it. Sky, it's out there that he's been sacked. What, 8 games into the season, Leicester are going to part ways with their one-time interim and then made permanent one-time assistant. Craig Shakespeare under Pearson, under Claudio Ranieri for the big title. He's been there for a long time. This was obviously a tough decision if they, in fact, have made the decision. And if we get some breaking news from the club, if they confirm it while we're on the pod, PM's got to tell me. But, yeah, that's some big news. Big news. So we'll see how that thing shakes out. The two Premier League topics today. Pep Guardiola at Manchester City absolutely flying. But first, we got to talk about Jose. Manchester United go to Anfield, okay? We kind of expected a defensive approach from Jose Mourinho. You would think Jurgen Klopp expected a defensive approach from Jose Mourinho. A 0-0 game that was not entertaining at all. And asked afterwards, both managers had a different thing to say about that, and this is what Jurgen Klopp had to say.
Oh, it's not my right to be frustrated. It's I'm sure if we would play like this, maybe you could not do this at Liverpool. Eh? That's how it is. So, but obviously, in Manchester, it's okay. I don't judge this. It's all okay.
So, just you can read into that one. You couldn't get away with this at Liverpool. I mean, that's a jab thrown at Jose Mourinho. So Jose Mourinho gets a chance. He didn't hear that quote from Jurgen Klopp because he was doing an interview around the same time, and this is what he had to say in his interview.
Could you have been more offensive with what you had?
Depends of your analyze. I know that for you and for the experts is easy to speak, but it's more difficult when you are on this side, when I know that Liverpool midfield was really, really strong. They never changed for 90 minutes. They are faster than us. When the game breaks, in broken situations, when there are distance between the lines, they are faster than us. And, you know, I had no chance to bring the game in another direction. So I think it's a positive point for us. And once more, we controlled them. They couldn't. I think quite frustrating for them.
So, Jose Mourinho, he says that they couldn't do it. They couldn't open up the game. And there were other quotes there that we didn't play there that were. That came after the game from Jose Mourinho, where he said, you know, it was a chess match and I, you know, the opportunities weren't there. Liverpool didn't open up. And all of these things that are very reactive of saying, you know, I was waiting to play a more open, aggressive game, but Liverpool just didn't give me that opportunity. I mean, give me a break. That's two games now at Anfield, right? So it's not as if this was a one-off. That's two games now at Anfield and a career of it. But let's just look at that in isolation. Where Manchester United had two shots on goal in those two games, two shots on goal.
And with that attacking force that he has at his hands, it blows your mind. I was watching back the shows just before I came in here, and pregame he's talking about all his injuries that he's facing, the midfield, the short midfield, et cetera, et cetera. But he says, "But I'm not going to complain about that." Like, you just complained about that.
He's the best.
I know. He's good for us.
He's the best. I mean, listen. Here's the thing. Here's the thing about Jose Mourinho. He's great in the press. He's just so good at it, and it's part of being a coach. He's good at the spin. He's good at creating these distractions, deflections, lines in the sand, us against you. But I mean, those comments are just ridiculous, and it's so funny. He says experts with such disdain. You know, I mean, he uses it in a pejorative way to say you experts. You know. It's not entertaining to you, but it's entertaining to some. No, it's not. It's not entertaining to anyone. The only people that are entertained by a game like that are Manchester United fans that are desperate for a title again. And by the way, Jose Mourinho has made a career on getting titles in this way. So he deserves credit for it. And on air, I've said that reluctantly because I want to be entertained. And, you know, Jurgen Klopp made a comment there that kind of said it all. He said, I'm not judging. Of course he is. He hates it. He's frustrated. He thinks that he's being risky. He's being attacking-minded. He wants to entertain the crowd. He wants it to be a good game, and it frustrates him and it makes him furious, as it does many, that Jose Mourinho basically shuts the thing down and won't allow it to become an exciting, you know, toe-for-toe, big powerhouse teams battling each other. And that's his prerogative. Jose Mourinho can do that. That's his prerogative. He's proved he can win that way. But here's my thing. everyone knows, if you're a Tad Potter, you know this, and the Manchester United fans are going to be rolling their eyes right now because even in the reviews, they tell me, stop picking on Jose Mourinho, Manchester United. I said before Jose Mourinho got this job, I thought it was a bad idea. I get why they're doing it because since Sir Alex Ferguson, they've struggled. They haven't been in title races. They've struggled to get in the top four. They're not anything like they used to be, and what can start that again is a title. So Jose Mourinho, if you're going to hire a manager, is one of the best options out there if you want to win a title. I totally get that. But what it costs in terms of the blow-up that typically happens when he leaves, that leaves, you know, shambles for someone else to pick up, that's one cost. But I think that's a cost that's worth it right now. The other cost is to watch that game. Liverpool-Manchester United is Manchester United's biggest rivalry. I mean, Manchester City isn't their biggest rival. If you ask any Manchester United fan or former player, they say it's Liverpool because they're the two most successful English teams in the game. That's the big game. So to have this huge marquee game, we sit here, we build it up, and for Jose Mourinho to turn it into what we just watched, just turgid, languid, defensive, park the bus, use anything you want, that's what it is. And I think Jose Mourinho's bad for the game because of that. I do. I know that's a bold statement, but he's a great manager. He wins titles. His success is incredible. He deserves credit for that. But I want to be entertained. And this season, we've seen a bit of entertainment. Granted, their games so far this season before they got to Liverpool were against all teams in the bottom nine, the current bottom nine. So, yeah, they showed that they can open up, that they can score goals. Lukaku's look excellent. Mata's look good. Rashford's look good. Martial's come on and scored great goals. Mkhitaryan, Pogba, all of it looks excellent. I mean, right from the first game of the season against West Ham, they looked irresistible. But Jose Mourinho, when he's won with Chelsea, when he's won with with a different team in the Premier League, he's proved that, yeah, he's not only a defensive-minded manager. His teams can open up, they can play, they can entertain, they can excite. But his default in big games that we look forward to is to ruin them, by playing the way they played against Liverpool and taking all the creativity, all of the space, all of the risk out of the game and getting out there with a point. And listen, that point might lead to him getting a title. So it's a strategy that's worked, and you can't blame him for doing it. But why I say he's bad for the game is if you looked at West Brom that played Monday night, right, against Leicester, or West Brom in general. Tony Pulis gets a lot of criticism for how defensive-minded they are. West Brom was more attacking and more aggressive and more risk-taking against Leicester away than Manchester United were away at Liverpool. I mean, in a sort of, if you looked at, you put both of those games in silhouette, you wouldn't be able to pick the Manchester United team out from the West Brom team. And with the money that he's spent, the money that's been spent since Sir Alex Ferguson left, the quality of players they have, it's inexcusable to give us a game like that. And why I say he's bad for the game is not only because all of these big games that we look forward to that have all the publicity that almost a billion people around the world are watching have to endure that, but managers that are coming up see the success he has in playing that way. And they try to emulate it, like anything. You know, people are trying to be like Pep. People are trying to do that. And people will try to be like Jose. And that's the best big comparison is Jose Mourinho didn't get the Barcelona job when Pep hadn't been a first-team manager yet and was working with the B team. The job was given to Pep Guardiola because Jose Mourinho had been with Barcelona. He'd been there. He knew them. He had a relationship. He was already a successful manager. He didn't get that job because Barcelona can't play that way. Just like Klopp said of Liverpool, by the way, yep, who haven't won a Premier League title, he said, we can't afford to play that way at Liverpool.
So Mourinho's brought into United to win a title.
Flat out.
Is he too scared to play attacking, free-flowing football?
No.
Is it fear?
It's not that. It's that this is who he is. And what's funny about it is there's a bit of a sort of oxymoron here. He doesn't care what people think, right? So he's able to play that way and know that he's going to get crushed and criticized and try to convince very talented attacking players to buy into that and say, listen, let's curb the appetite to attack. Mm-hmm. I know that you're a world-class player, but today, Lukaku, you're going to have to sit on an island by yourself and play as if you were playing for West Brom. It's going to feel a lot like when you were there. So he does that. But what's so funny about it is it seems like it kills him. And all of his comments afterwards, he's so defensive. He's so He's so antagonistic. And also, one comment he made in the aftermath of this game was, you know what? I don't know if I want to stay at Manchester United for very long. And the PSG link comes up. And Manchester United, by the way, has asked him to sort of clean that up and clear it out. You know what he wanted to do? He wanted to say, other people want me. You know, PSG wants me. And that's what he does in the aftermath of games like this when he's criticized, is he points at other people and say, you know, they play this way too, or this is Jurgen Klopp's fault. He didn't try to play attacking-minded, which is why I couldn't.
Yeah, he didn't make any – he was saying, I was waiting for Klopp to make a change, and then I was going to make a change.
I mean, see – And that was the first big test of the season. Now, I still think they're in a title race. And listen, they're in second place. They're 2 points behind Manchester City. So it's all going according to plan. But if that's what we're going to see in every big game from this incredible attacking-minded team, it's just so disappointing. If I'm a Manchester United fan, I'm thinking to myself, this isn't worth it. But there are many that disagree with me. Many Manchester United fans will say, whatever it takes to be winners again, to win a title. And let me just, one last thing. He won two trophies, right, last year. So Europa League, obviously a second-tier competition for Manchester United, but a trophy they'd never won. The League Cup, a second-tier competition to FA Cup. You know, it works. It wins. But I would just, it's never going to happen. I would love Jose Mourinho to prove that he can let talent go, be as good as they can, be a little more attacking-minded. But it's never going to happen, which is why I go back to, I just don't think he's great for the game, because as much as we love his antics and his sound bites, and as much as everyone loves a winner and he's a serial winner, what we have to endure in the games we most look forward to, I just don't think is worth it.
Jose out. Maybe not.
No.
Maybe not.
No, because, I started it with saying, I get it, right? I get why they told Sir Bobby Charlton, listen, we'll give you a stand if you shut your mouth, because we want to bring in Jose Mourinho. And Sir Bobby Charlton didn't want him for many reasons, style being one of them. And this gets us on perfectly to the next topic, which is on a weekend where we watch a painfully glacial, just paint-drying game between Liverpool and Manchester United. We watch Manchester City absolutely dismantle Stoke. There was one headline that was amazing that Neil Ashton did in the best of the back pages, and it was, what a score, what a bore. So what a score for the Manchester City game, what a bore for Manchester United. I mean, it couldn't have been a bigger contrast. The difference is stark. I mean, it's so Montague Capulet, this Pep Jose thing. And part of me loves it, because Jose's proved that he can win that way in the Premier League. That's proven. Jose's a proven winner in the Premier League. This is his ground. When it comes to Pep, he finally is in a space where he has the bragging rights. But if Pep can do what he's doing right now, he looks like he's created a Barcelona, a Bayern Munich, a powerful, irresistible, fluent, dominant, title-winning team with Manchester City. Now, it will be harder than any league he's done it in before. And for that, I think if Pep wins the title, it will be his best ever accomplishment. I really do believe that. You know, some would say, listen, winning the Premier League isn't as hard. I mean, you know, Barcelona, Real Madrid is one of the best teams in the world. You know, it's hard to beat them. And Spain is fluid. It's competitive. You know, Germany's fluid. It's competitive. And they'd say, look, Leicester won the Premier League. So obviously it's not that hard. No, Leicester won the Premier League. That shows you how hard it is. Because if teams like Leicester, who are typically fighting promotion relegation, can win the Premier League, it's so competitive. So winning it is difficult. Winning it is remarkably challenging. And winning it the way that Pep is trying to win it hasn't worked recently. Jose's done it with Chelsea in a sort of defense-first counterattacking way. Antonio Conte picked that up. Leicester won the Premier League with almost never outpossessing their opponents. Mm-hmm. So Pep is trying to do it in a way that you don't win the Premier League recently. And even go back to like Liverpool teams and even some of those Manchester United teams. You know, people kind of forget that they were defensively stable. I mean, those Liverpool teams, that success.
We're talking pre-Premier League, obviously.
Yeah, pre-Premier League.
Yeah.
I mean, talking English soccer top flight, they did it on a defensive strength that they had. And even runs recently where they've come close, they failed under Brendan Rodgers because they didn't have a strong defensive unit. They're failing a bit under Jurgen Klopp because they don't have that. So what Pep's doing right now with I mean, that game, 9 straight wins in all competitions, outscoring opponents 35-4. I mean, they're just wiping the floor with people. Unbeaten in the Premier League season, 7-1-0. 6 straight Premier League wins. I mean, it's just, it feels, I guess on paper, it looks as dominant as they were last year, PM. But the eye test, it's so much different. They are a much better team this year than they were last year.
Now, question for you. You say that this would be Pep's greatest ever achievement. Is it tainted by the fact that they just throw money? He says, oh, I need a left back, I need a right back, I need Gabriel Jesus, I need another, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
He just gets to build his team however he sees fit.
I get that criticism, and I say it has something to do with it because, listen, he obviously couldn't do this with Crystal Palace. I mean, the money gives him the tools to do what he can do, but I don't think others with that money can do it as well as he can do it. And by the way, other teams are spending huge
right.
money. I mean, Manchester City are consistently, if not the biggest spender, right up there. But it's not as if people aren't throwing out money next to him. Mm. And by the way, when he did it at Barcelona, Real Madrid had plenty of money to spend. Bayern Munich, I think, is the only situation where he was drastically outspending his competition. And not only that, buying his competition's talent from them.
Sucking Dortmund dry.
Yeah. So what he's doing here with Manchester City, if it leads to a title, will confirm what many suggest, that he's the greatest mind in the game.
Do you think this squad is good enough to compete on multiple platforms?
Yeah, I think they are. Mendy was a massive loss. Mm-hmm. I mean, losing him to an ACL injury for the year, you know, what that's done recently is brought in Fabian Delph. And Delph, who's a midfielder, we all know, has kind of showed this other piece. You know, what we saw at Bayern Munich, where he wanted to bring Alaba, which is the perfect comparison because Alaba for Austria is a center midfielder.
Yeah.
Use a left back that can play in those inside channels, like he tried to do in the first season with Kolarov, with Clichy, with Sanya, but couldn't, with Zabaleta, but couldn't. Now he has that up his sleeve, but that's a big loss. Gundogan's back. He's been playing. I mean, he obviously is coming back from a big injury, but he's been coming back from big injuries a lot over the past few years of his career and still getting back to a pretty impressive height. Kevin De Bruyne is the best player in the world right now. I mean,
wow.
Messi is always going to be thought of as that. And listen, Messi is the best player in the world. But Kevin De Bruyne in this stretch, I mean, obviously Messi getting his team to the World Cup with a hat-trick helps his cause. Mm-hmm. But Kevin De Bruyne right now, I'm watching everyone. I'm watching Cristiano Ronaldo. I'm watching, you know, Mane and everyone on the Ballon d'Or list that came out and Suarez. I mean, Kevin De Bruyne is the most influential player in the world right now in terms of he brings goal scoring, he brings composure. He's got a big defensive responsibility in this Manchester City team. I mean, you forget when they've switched to one holder with Silva and De Bruyne having to be, you know, sort of inverted wingers, double pivot ahead of that one holder. He's having to track back and do a lot of defensive work, but it's not affecting his production whatsoever. And just the quality of service, the vision. Watch this last game, Stoke, and watch the highlights if you haven't seen the game. I mean, some of the passes he picks out, the quality of the pass, the vision, the timing, it's all just top level. It's as good as you get.
Does he represent sort of the embodiment or the epitome of a modern footballer? He's got size. He doesn't look that big, but he is.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a couple years
when we were over there at Stamford Bridge. Yeah,
at Stamford Bridge, we were sitting really close to the field. He is also really quick.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't see that either. So he's got the size, he's got the strength. He's never going to do, you know, he doesn't have Kyle Martino feet. He's not going to get by anyone. With
he doesn't need him.
Any snake fakes or anything.
Yeah, I needed tricks because I wasn't very smart.
But he can shoot the ball from wherever, all over the pitch. He can spray balls left and right, and he can get into a tackle.
He is, I actually went into the MLS studios recently, and we did this really fun digital roundtable that's coming out. I'm not sure when, but look for that with Sasha Kljestan and Alejandro Moreno.
How many times did he dive?
Yeah, we didn't talk about diving because I fall into that category as well. And we talked about number 10s and how, you know, what that means to us, how it's changed. You know, is it kind of extinct in the idea that it used to be and mm-hmm. what it used to be? We've talked about Valderrama and some of the guys in MLS that we've loved over the years and Echeverri. And And the number 10 position as a luxury role doesn't exist anymore. And what happens is you take number 10 quality type players, and Kevin De Bruyne is one, and you have to find a different way to use them. So one way to do it is to make them sort of a false nine, right? To give them the freedom of playing as high as you want so that they don't have to do a lot of defensive things. They do that with Messi a lot.
Yep.
You know, now that they have Suarez, they don't have to. You know, you do that with Alexis sometimes. Or you make him a sort of inverted winger like they try to do with Mesut Ozil, but people still are critical of Mesut Ozil because he is – you carry him through some games. Kevin De Bruyne is what a number 10 is now, which is you have to find a way to not be a luxury. They don't carry him at all. Absolutely not. I mean, he does everything. He defends. He builds out of the back. He gets in wide positions and gives them service. He's a goal-scoring threat. He links with strikers. I mean, he and David Silva's the same way. Both of those guys are number 10s. I mean, they encapsulate all of the qualities of a number 10. And in the old days, they would have sat there in the middle wearing the number 10, enjoying a bit of a walk of the park and getting on the ball and pulling the strings, you know, composer. Mm-hmm. But now, to your point, there are these modern complete players that just have to be able to do it all because the game is stronger, it's faster, more ground is covered, and the attacking impetus has been passed to actually some defensive players where playmakers are kind of fullbacks, a lot of them. You know, I mean, that's kind right. of become a modern playmaker. So what used to be the number 10, that creative responsibility has been sort of, it has been distributed throughout other positions. And now other responsibilities that now as defenders fly forward are being passed on to what used to be a number 10. So it's been a fascinating evolution. And Kevin De Bruyne is right at the apex of all of that.
We're going to run out of time right here, but just as a callback, Mourinho let him leave Chelsea.
Yeah, and there's obviously a couple players come up when you talk about Jose Mourinho, and Lukaku's another one that he fortunately got back. Matic, by the way, was one that he let go and got back at Chelsea, and now he's got him back.
Right.
So he didn't let him go the second time. He was let go.
Well, we're about to run out of time, but you know, I can't help but think, like, what would De Bruyne look like
if he was still at Chelsea?
Or in this United squad? Like, how would he look in that starting 11?
It'd be amazing. It'd be amazing. I mean, here's the thing. Jose Mourinho doesn't stay long. And because of that, he doesn't play a lot of young guys. And he doesn't deal with a lot of BS. And that helps him succeed. To defend Jose Mourinho a little bit, Lukaku and Kevin De Bruyne weren't willing to wait it out. I mean, so it was more them being unhappy and saying, listen, I don't want to be here. Jose Mourinho would have loved to, kind of like what he's done with Mkhitaryan.
Right. Well, I should have been more pointed with my question. Like, how would Mourinho use a modern, you know, a current Kevin De Bruyne?
Well, what he's done with Mkhitaryan is the same thing he did with Kevin De Bruyne, which is you're not ready. You're not doing what I want. You've got to wait your time. And Mkhitaryan, to his credit, did. And Kevin De Bruyne didn't. So again, it's easy to say Jose Mourinho missed out on another talent, but really, Kevin De Bruyne is an example of a talent that knew he was good enough to play and didn't want to wait for his opportunities. All right, last topic.
Do you want 10 minutes on this, or you want more on this?
We might have to. I think we're gonna forget the whistle.
We're gonna have to.
We're gonna have to just go.
Okay.
We're gonna have to just go. The dust is settled, right? Here we are, and we know a bit more now. There's been interviews. There's been a conference call with U.S. Soccer. Bruce Arena has resigned, and Sunil Gulati has given some of his thoughts. Here are my feelings now. Still angry, still disappointed, still heartbroken. And the things that have been said recently have not assuaged any of my fears and concerns. They've actually made them worse. When Sunil Gulati got on the press conference or the conference call recently and said, I take full responsibility, and the next question a minute later was, do you plan to run or resign? What's the deal? He said, no, I have no plans to resign. Just conflicting messages right there. It feels like, and I tweeted this right afterwards, faux accountability. Sunil Gulati isn't responsible for the lowest moment in U.S. soccer history, but he absolutely is culpable. And he's coming up in February. There's another election where he can have one more term. And he shouldn't take it. He shouldn't run again. He should say right now, I put my hand up. I'm at the center of this. It's been challenging. I want to believe I've left the program in a better place than I found it, but it's time for a new vision. It's time for someone else to come in and try to help U.S. soccer rebuild right now, become a phoenix from the flames, and push on and accomplish what we've all set out to accomplish. And I will help the transition. I will be here to make sure that we get the right person in. But now is not the time for me to take things forward. I would stand up and I'd say, that's what I want from my president. I love that. That's accountability. But we haven't seen that. And I tweeted this out. I'm so disappointed in him for not doing that. What we have right now is a problem without a lot of solutions. I don't see anyone really saying what needs to be done. I see questions about what could potentially be the problems, but I just don't see any focus on the solutions. And you know, Sunil Gulati, and Robbie Musto said this when we talked this weekend when we did a segment on air, and said that Robbie moved here just as Sunil Gulati got the job. And U.S. soccer had its high water moment in 2002 in the World Cup. That's the high water mark. Mm-hmm. And that was before Sunil got here. U.S. soccer was ranked in the top 10 in FIFA. That was before Sunil got here. So it's not as if he took over a struggling group and has delivered them to a level that they hadn't achieved before. I don't mention that to discredit what he's done, because he's done good things. He's been there, and the job is challenging. The landscape, the soccer landscape, as far as a federation goes, is the most challenging out of major countries that are ranked in the top 50 in FIFA. I mean, he's dealing with a soccer landscape that is swimming upstream in many ways because of the other sports that it's competing with, because of how big our country is, because of many things. But right now, not raising his hand and saying we've failed, we've let soccer fans in this country down, and something needs to be done. I take responsibility, which means stepping down. Nothing changes. And if nothing changes, failing to qualify for the World Cup is only the second worst thing that's happened in this year to U.S. soccer. If nothing changes, then we're destined to repeat a lot of these mistakes. And I'm not breaking this now, Mike, because articles have come out about it recently, and I've gone public with this, and I never intended to, but I've decided to go public with the fact that behind the scenes, I've thought about running for U.S. soccer president. And first, let me talk about why. I've thought about running for U.S. soccer president because I have a platform. I love this game. I love the program. I've worn the jersey. I've been in the locker room. I know how devastated the guys are right now, and I'm mad at them because they didn't put in a performance that they should have in a game they should have won. So I'm mad at them. I'm not excusing the players. They deserve some of this blame, but it's so much bigger than that. We're missing the forest for the trees if we're blaming the players for the game in Trinidad and Tobago. Because here's the thing, is if they did win that game, then it would have papered over so many cracks that exist. And this would have been a collapse that would have happened eventually. I liken it to sort of the financial collapse, right? So you go way back, the signs were there where, there's predatory loaning and people are getting mortgages that they shouldn't because they can't afford them, that has small print, that the rates go up and they don't know that, and default rates increase, and these mortgages get wrapped up into securities that are rated AAA but aren't even close because the lack of transparency and regulation creates an industry of corruption where this powder keg situation is created. And in 2008, there's a huge financial collapse that could have been seen if people were looking for the signs. This collapse, the Trinidad and Tobago collapse, could have been seen if people were looking for the signs. So right now in the aftermath of this soccer collapse, someone needs to point to these things. Someone needs to go back and look at all the red flags that have been there, and no one's doing it. And you know, some people are raising their hands right now, but the reason I decided, you know what, I need to seriously consider running for U.S. soccer president, it came off the back of some people I really respect in the soccer community reaching out to me privately and saying, you have to do this. Like, step up. I've seen the things you're saying. You can be a voice for change. fraud's not the right word, but I just hated the feeling of sitting here in a studio with a microphone or on air and saying what I'm saying, being passionate and challenging the status quo, challenging our soccer community to step up and help fix this thing. I felt a little bit like I was dissatisfied with just that. And I thought, you know what? I need to do more than that. And I need to put my money where my mouth is, and I need to run. And even if I can't beat Sunil, which, by the way, is going to be very, very difficult based on how absolute his power is at this moment, even if I can't beat him, I'm going to show that people are going to step up. But the reason I can't, and I've made the decision not to, is because the barrier to entry is a financial one. It's a volunteer position. Mm-hmm. So if I really wanted to do this, I would have to leave my dream job at NBC to do it. And listen, you know, maybe there are people that will leave their dream job to go do something like this. I mean, U.S. soccer president was never my dream job. I just feel compelled to act right now because I'm so protective of the team, but also protective of the game in this country. I believe in it. I was watching U.S. soccer when Hugo Perez was running around and fell in love with Tab Ramos and all of these guys that came up that turned me on, that made me think, this is for me. I went to those games in 94. I saw what was possible. I saw how magical it was. The league comes around. I've seen progress. And Sunil deserves credit for some progress during his era. But right now, I feel like it's in jeopardy of going back so many steps if we don't capitalize on the momentum right now in this devastating moment for change, the desire for change. So if I were to run, I would run on 3 points. First, transparency, right? One of the reasons Sunil can stay in the presidency, one of many reasons, is because he's compensated in other ways. He's on the FIFA council, and he makes money through that. And there's a situation that's hard to understand. Obviously, he's a professor at Columbia, and he makes a salary at that. But there's a situation going on with a nonprofit organization in U.S. soccer and a for-profit organization, Soccer United Marketing and Major League Soccer, that in the soccer Venn diagram, they overlap, and no one's ever explained to us how that's not a conflict of interest. So there might not be a conflict of interest, right? Sunil Gulati might not be on a board of a group that makes money that the U.S. president can make a decision on deals that they get. I mean, there might not be a conflict of interest, but from the outside, the perception of it is a major, major problem.
Just so I think you clarify maybe for the audience who doesn't know, Sunil Gulati, that's an unpaid position.
Yeah, so it's a volunteer role. And so, you know, the thing ends up being that first, the thing I would run on is we need clarity. We need transparency. There needs to be an outside, independent ethics audit to come in and explain to us why that's not a conflict of interest. Because I cannot justify running for U.S. soccer president right now because I would be doing it for free, and I can't do that. I can't do that to my family. I can't take on that burden right now. And one of the reasons Sunil Gulati can is because he's compensated, and his compensation isn't from U.S. soccer, and that compensation doesn't trigger any conflict of interest alarms currently. So maybe it doesn't, but there's just not enough transparency to know. The next thing I would run on would be the pay-for-play structure. So we know that too many kids aren't getting into the pipeline. We know that kids are getting priced out of playing soccer in this country at a high level. And all the statistics are there. There was a study that was put out recently that showed that the lowest income class in this country, the lowest participation among any sport of that income class is in soccer. It's a rich kid's game. I was a rich kid. I played it. If my parents gave me the bill for how much soccer cost them for me until I went to the University of Virginia and got a scholarship, I probably couldn't afford it. I mean, they must have accrued hundreds of thousands of dollars of you know, flying around, staying in hotels, playing in tournaments, paying $3,000 to $6,000 a year simply to be on the team and all that. You can't create a pipeline to the U.S. soccer team, to the national team, that excludes a huge class of players that probably have all of the intangibles and all of the qualities that make a great athlete. If you look around the world, some of the best players that play the game, not some of, the majority of them, come from low-income backgrounds, come from blue-collar backgrounds, come from favelas in Brazil. It's a breeding ground for some of the best players. So that would be another thing I'd run on. The irony is, the reason I can't run for U.S. soccer president right now and change that and make the game more affordable for kids and their families is because I can't afford to do it. I can't financially afford to not earn an income and take a volunteer position. And to go back to my first point of my sort of campaign pitch here, the transparency side of this thing, you make that a salaried position, accountability immediately. Mm. Immediately, there's accountability. We are paying your salary through the money that U.S. Soccer makes. Of that $150 million or $100 to $150 million, by the way, no one knows because there's not transparency, of surplus sitting in account with U.S. Soccer, you know, $500,000 of that goes a year to paying the U.S. Soccer president. I promise you, that's accountability. And you can say, we're paying you. I want to know what's going on. I want to know what's happening. So not only does it create accountability, but it grows the pool of potential candidates because I can't run for that reason. And I promise you, more qualified people than me are sitting here mulling it over, and they can't either because they just can't justify the financial burden of running for a volunteer position of a nonprofit organization. And it's not as if it's illegal. You can pay a president of a nonprofit. I mean, the CEO, Dan Flynn, makes a salary. He's a day-to-day employee who's earning an income. So you can do it, which raises the question, why not? And then I'll move on to my last sort of bullet point in my stump speech here, my campaign pitch, is promotion relegation is the future. It's absolutely the future. It's how the game is played all over the world. This is the world's game. It's the most important game in the world. We are the most multicultural society. I mean, we are a melting pot in America, and we are full of people that come from countries where soccer is the number one sport and still love the game. And promotion relegation, an open system, challenges stability. I get that. And you know what? The single entity thing with Major League Soccer, I know Don Garber very well. I have a relationship with him. I respect him. He's done a great job of delivering an excellent product and probably needed the single entity model to as an insurance policy against what happened with the NASL, which is getting too top heavy, spending and collapsing on yourself. I get it. But the future is an open system. The future is promotion relegation. And that will accomplish a couple things. One is, obviously, there are MLS owners that want to spend big, but can't because they're capped in the current structure. There are some MLS owners that don't want to, and they like the single entity because it's downside risk protection. But these owners will spend. Natural sort of the haves and have-nots will happen, as it does in any sport. That will create incredible competition, but it also will create a differentiation. You will stick out in a crowd of sports here. There are other sports that will never go promotion relegation. And to give our sport a leg up in a crowded sports landscape, in a sports landscape where we're struggling to get market share, it's just one extra thing to get people excited about it. We do the Premier League every year, right? And every year, what's more exciting, the title race or the relegation battle?
Usually the relegation.
The relegation battle. The title race is normally figured out with two or three games to go. Only one time in the Premier League history, and maybe it's just when we... No, I'm trying to think. I've read somewhere, the going down to the last day, it's only happened a few times.
I think it's two or three times. Most recently, it
was Manchester
first,
City. Yeah,
the
with
first year of our coverage.
Yeah, first year of our coverage. So it's only happened once since we've had it.
Yeah.
And that's rare. So the relegation is... And we try to use playoffs to create this sort of artificial, you know, build-up.
Yeah.
And that's an American thing, and it works in sports. But
yeah, well, they have playoffs in, you know, the championship and other leagues, in Germany and stuff, lower leagues.
So that's one thing it does. The other thing it does is one of the things that failed in Trinidad and Tobago was a team that was complacent, right? A team that didn't fight, a team that didn't show their quality, much better team on paper than the team they played against, a team with much more to play for than the team they played against, but they didn't win. Because the character, the heart, the fight wasn't there. And I'm so mad at the guys for that. And some of them have come out and said that afterwards. Part of that gets solved by opening up this, going back to my other point of pay for play, opening up the game to people that have that characteristic, right? That are used to fighting for things, that are used to overcoming adversity. But the other part is growing up and playing in Major League Soccer in a promotion relegation system will create that. You will play games that mean everything. You will play games that if you lose, you will go down to another division. And fans that you see out in the restaurant and livelihoods will be hanging on that game. It creates an importance that doesn't currently exist in the Major League Soccer structure. But it's going to be so difficult to move us towards that because the status quo, again, I go back to, if things don't change, we're destined to repeat the failures of the past. So I'm left in a really tough position because this isn't about me. And the reason I decided to go public with the fact I was considering running was not to put myself in print, not to push myself into the conversation. It wasn't a PR move. It was because I was really struggling with this. And I wanted to shed light on and bring attention to not me, but bring attention to why people like me and people more qualified than me aren't raising their hand right now. And you know, I'm looking at the people that have raised their hand to say they're going to challenge Sunil Gulati, and I'm unimpressed. And listen, I'm going to remain open-minded, okay? I'm going to let them say their piece. I'm going to wait to hear what their plan is. Because that's fair.
That's going to be my question, you know, not now, but at some point, are you going to be publicly endorsing someone?
You know, I think here's the thing. One of the reasons that it becomes difficult from my position is I can't be critical of a possible conflict of interest at the top of our soccer pyramid and ask for transparency there. And then, you know, and then be involved in an obvious conflict of interest where I work for NBC Sports and we get in bid discussions and we comment on players. And so if I needed to do this and if I wanted to go all the way, it would have to be leaving NBC to do that. And I don't want to do that. I love where I work. I love who I work with. And I think what we're doing is special. And I think it's important. I think it's growing the game in this country. And I love doing it. The reason I've thought about leaving all of this and walking away from my dream job is because I would hope I could make a bigger difference by running for the U.S. soccer president and getting that job and changing things. But if I can't do that, and I can't, I honestly, Mike, I've been thinking about how to do this. I've had tough conversations in my kitchen with my wife and trying to figure out. She was supportive of me, as scary as it is to take on these challenges. But it boils down to, I can't even get into the, am I willing to leave my dream job to do this discussion? Because it's just not possible. I can't afford to do it. I'm not going to put that financial burden on my family. I mean, I'd have to sell my house and change my lifestyle to, yeah. Honestly, I mean, I'm not trying to be dramatic, to do this. And To answer your question, I know sort of like there's a roundabout way to getting to it. I just don't think that I can cross that line.
Well, I think that's a fair point.
What I can do from my vantage point, what I can do with this microphone and from the studio as an NBC analyst, is ask the right questions and point to the right things, and that's what I'm doing.
Okay,
I'm pointing to, I think we need to move on from Sunil Gulati. I'm also pointing to, and let me say this, I know this is a little bit tangential. Sunil Gulati's a human, okay? Sunil Gulati has done a good job. I would say over the arc of his time there, he's done some important things. And by the way, if he walks away from the U.S. presidency, he still very much is a part of U.S. soccer. He's on the FIFA council. He's going to be a part of the 2026 bid process. But for people right now to be putting out his public information and to be making vile, vitriolic comments right now is inexcusable. And it's really disappointing. And by the way, you're doing no good. You're helping no one. Because a lot of us are angry and are going about it the right way. And that's how we change things. But you sitting there and being cruel and nasty and awful and forgetting the fact that this is just a game, that doesn't mean it can't be important. That doesn't mean it doesn't feel like everything to so many people, and it doesn't have to do with livelihoods. I mean, listen, my life is fueled by this game. I mean, I, I'm I'm taking care of my kids with this game. So obviously it means a lot, but not enough to be cruel to another human like I'm seeing out there. So let's cut that crap out. But sort of lastly, to finish off this whole thing, all I can do now from my position is hope that the right candidates come forward. And no, I'm not going to endorse one, and I will continue to ask the right questions. I will continue to try to, from my vantage point and from my position, open up the possibility to more candidates. Hopefully people hear the call about the volunteer position. And right now, on the Athletes Council, where I have a lot of friends that I used to play with, and executive positions, I have friends that I used to play with. Hopefully they hear this clarion call, and they put in, even if Sunil stays, what can fix a glaring issue that will exist after he's gone, which is we have to open up the possibility to get great candidates for this role. But just a little sort of anecdote about being unimpressed with people running. I'm not picking on this guy, right? I'm impressed with some of the things he's done early. But Steve Gantz, right? Boston guy who's involved with the sport, lawyer, who created a website about his campaign that he's running. I went on the website and I read it. I read his points. He's got some good ones. I like what he's running on. I like what he wants to accomplish. At the end of his website, there's a little link that says click here for examples of how he was going to solve some of these issues. It's a broken link. It doesn't work. It goes to a 404, not found page. Now, that's a small thing, right? This guy could still maybe be the person that can lead U.S. soccer forward. I'm not going to, with such an insignificant thing, I'm not going to rule him out. I want to hear what he has to say. But just tiny little things like that. The thing that scares me most right now is the opposition right now and against Sunil and the status quo, the desire for change is the greatest it's ever been. I mean, the American Outlaws came out with their own statement saying that Sunil Gulati should move on. I mean, this is big, right, Mike? I mean, we've been in this game for a long time. This is as big as the resistance has ever felt. What terrifies me is that the momentum of that and the window that opens for a challenger invites an opportunist who's not qualified to take this group forward, and we end up jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. So you know, I raise that Steve Gantz thing not because I think he's one of those guys, but just because if you're going to come right now, if you're going to raise your hand right now, come right. Make sure. And listen, other guys haven't even started a website, so Steve deserves credit for that. But, like, make sure you're doing this right. And I know that that's kind of incongruous with it's a volunteer position. So it is a part-time job. So people are kind of coming at it in a part-time way. Come at it in a full-time way. It will be a full-time position. It needs to be a full-time position. It's too important to give it a volunteer role. So just come right. And by the way, if you're thinking about it, if you're sitting on the sidelines, if you're just tiptoeing, it's I know this sounds hypocritical because I'm not jumping in with both feet, but if you're close, do it. Do it. If you think you can make change, step up. Because even if no one beats Sunil Gulati in this election, I think the message needs to be the status quo isn't good enough. And we have to expect more. And if Sunil continues on for four more years, it has to be because he's heard that. It has to be because he's heard that and he promises and spends every day proving that he's trying to execute that promise to change the things that we know are wrong with our system. So that's my U.S. soccer piece.
Can I ask you one question about U.S. soccer?
Yeah.
So the under 17 team.
Yes. Let's start talking about good things.
They're in the quarterfinals.
Ugh.
Let's say they go on. Maybe they make it to the final
to play England in the next game. That'd be amazing.
Let's just say they have a very successful run and they second. Maybe they win this tournament.
Yeah.
Is the entire conversation about the struggling development of American soccer players pivoted? Is it
no,
over?
That's dangerous. That's really dangerous. Because look at England, right? Look at the success they're having at the youth level. Is that translating to the first
team?
They
had a pretty good qualifying campaign, England.
We'll see if they have a good tournament. They haven't done that in a very long time. So, you know, that youth success does not mean the system's fixed. Does it mean that there are good parts about it? Yeah, absolutely. Do we have to tear the whole thing up? No, that's not what I'm not sitting here saying burn it down, let's build it again. I'm saying that we can look at what's going on and keep the good as a foundation, but change what we know needs to be changed. So these groups coming up, we need to identify why they're succeeding and put focus on that, time and effort. Because I also don't want to make it seem like U.S. soccer isn't doing anything for youth development, because of course they are, and of course they're addressing these things. And the guys that I know on the board, the guys that I know in the Athletes Council, care very much about these issues and are voicing them every time they get the opportunity. But you know, Landon, by the way, Golden Boot in the Under-17 World Cup, Silver Boot, I think that was DeMarcus Beasley in that Under-17 World Cup. That was a pretty good World Cup, yeah. Right? How'd that work out?
Well, they went on and led the U.S. to their greatest World Cup run.
Those two guys were teenagers with a bunch of guys that played college soccer.
Yeah, but you know, there was something of a sign there that you had these players dominating on an international tournament that led to domination on the world stage.
Yeah. What you need to be careful of is IDing the wrong things. So taking success in that World Cup, for instance, and saying it's because the pay for play system works so well. You know what? Landon Donovan played for a club team and Redlands, and you know, that club team helped him get to where he's going. You know, you could make the mistake of connecting dots that aren't there.
Okay.
You know, because the youth soccer situation, for instance, two things that need to be figured out, which is a part of the pay for play, which, listen, I get that pay for play is going to be hard to solve. It's going to take time. It's going to take money. But you know things that you can do immediately that don't take time and don't take money? Fix the solidarity payment situation. Fix the training compensation payment. All across the world, if a club team trains a 14-year-old and that 14-year-old is bought by a team, that club team gets the training compensation and gets a solidarity payment, which says, thank you for developing this talent, so that we can incentivize you to continue to do this, here's a nice chunk of change. And by the way, when he gets sold on and continues to move on, I mean, Bastian Schweinsteiger, when he was sold to Manchester United, his club team from when he was a teenager got probably like $60,000-$70,000. I mean, that's how it works across the world. We don't do that here. Why? Answer me that. And then the next thing. So don't pretend like for a second that pay for play, listen, all of a sudden it has to all be free. Like, I'm going to sound like Bernie Sanders of like the soccer, you know, everything's free. Everything's going to be paid for. No, but here's one thing you can do that doesn't cost money, right? Go back to that low income class conversation we were just having before, right? The group that we're missing, the group the net's not catching. Kids in the lowest income in inner cities are 50% more likely to play basketball than play soccer. Right. And what's strange about that group is it's mixed between blacks and Latinos. Latinos are those soccer players. I mean, it's stereotypically, that's the sport that they love, that they watch, that they celebrate. They're not getting in the net. So 50% are more likely to go do that. Why is that? It's because access, money, and fields. Mm-hmm. You know what you can do? I've flown all over the world, and I know you have too, and you've seen this. Europe, South America, put a friggin' soccer goal underneath every single basketball hoop, on every basketball court in every city in you know, Chicago, yep. Los Angeles, in New York.
Roll out the futsal.
And I promise you, kids will play. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to be cheesy. If you build it, they will come. Put the field, put the game there. Because, by the way, that's also what we're missing, is pay-for-play is such a structured, overcoached world. And listen, there's a time and a place for that. But kids need to be playing in pickup games. I became a skillful player. And I'm sort of a unique American player because I took on a creativity that I think is rare. And you know me from growing up, so I don't want to sit here and like toot my own horn. But like that, people that have played with me would
Absolutely.
Say that was part of my game.
Yep.
You know where that came from? And you know this because I'd friggin' ring your phone all the time when it was snowing outside. And I'd say, get in the car, come to the field. I've got five guys. We're going to play a pickup game. Yep. We're going to play 1v1.
Unstructured play.
It would come from that.
Yep.
And the other thing I did was I would pay $5 to play in the field house with the Hispanic adults and get my butt kicked and try to figure out how to compete. And I'd play indoor with Jamaican adults that Edson Buttle would take me with his dad in Old Greenwich. And that's where I got that. Kids will get the creativity, the skill, the competition. Because, by the way, those basketball players, they're primed to get into a much more inclusive group, but they're taught this. You know what? Winner stays on. Winner stays on creates a winner. Mm-hmm. Winner stays on creates competitive drive. Winner stays on in a pickup game, you're friggin' devastated when you lose that game. You got to wait to get back on the field. That stuff sounds insignificant, but it's real. Put a goal. What will that cost? And by the way, all you have to deal with is upsetting a couple basketball players, you know, that say don't play soccer on this. But I promise you, fighting to get on that field is part of it. Fighting to say, when this basketball game's over, I don't care what you say, we're playing. Fighting is saying when the basketball guys show up, we're not leaving. I mean, that all of that's important. And no one's saying this. No one's throwing out these suggestions. And so, you know what, to people thinking about running, Tad Potters, if there's any qualified presidential candidates out there, steal my ideas. Take them. Have them. Flush them out. Fix them. You know, make them work. Put them in writing and go and run for the U.S. soccer presidency, because someone has to. Someone has to.
Before you sign off,
yeah,
Lester, official, Shakespeare gone.
Oh, there it is.
The terminology they're using is that they've parted. He's parted ways.
Well, that's a paid position. Maybe I'll just run for. I'll try to get the Lester coaching role.
If you do that, it's not going to be a long stay. Based on their history,
that one at least I don't have to think about, because I
don't
absolutely
move,
I say, don't, no
don't
chance.
Take the kids out of school and move them all over there.
Yeah. Oh, Shakespeare. A Shakespearean tragedy. All right, Tap Water, stand with me.